When they left their quarters, Domi and Lakesh found the corridor empty. Lakesh was dressed in his usual jumpsuit and had, on Domi's insistence, tied a kerchief over the bottom half of his face to act as a filter for the air. Domi wore a pair of camo pants, flat boots with twin knives held in sheaths on the inside leg, and an olive vest top. Like Lakesh, she had placed a kerchief over her mouth and nose, but she pulled it away to sniff the air.
It's out here, too! There's something in the air!
I can't smell anything.
It's not a smell, it's a weight, a heaviness. There's a density to the air that shouldn't be there.
Lakesh made his way down the corridor, passing the closed doors of the personnel sleeping quarters until he reached an equipment locker that had been molded into the wall over the nook holding a fire extinguisher. He opened the cabinet and pulled out two breathing filters, small gas masks that could be strapped or held over the bottom half of a person's face. He passed one to Domi as they continued down the corridor toward the fire door that led to stairwell D. Once they were in the concrete-walled stairwell, Lakesh pushed down the kerchief, letting it hang around his neck, and held the mask over the lower half of his face.
What's going on, Domi?
Holding her own rebreather to her mouth, Domi checked up and down the concrete staircase.
I'm not sure, but there's definitely something coming through the air vents. Could be a malfunction.
Sounds like a glitch. Let's check out the machine room.
There was a drumming pressure at the back of Shizuka's skull. She opened her eyes and found herself lying face down on a bed of something soft. Whatever it was, it reeked. She pushed herself up from the sliding ooze, still feeling the bashing at the back of her head. The room was dimly lit, but after a moment she made out the walls, stained and smeared, and the piles of garbage all around her. She looked to her right and saw where the platform of trash she lay on ended, dropping off like the edge of a shelf. Kneeling amid the trash, Shizuka calmed her thoughts, focusing her mind inward as her samurai training had taught her. The noise was not just from the exterior, she realized. It was within her. There was a pain, a pounding ache like a hammer against her head. And the noise was coming from inside her head, too. The pounding of rushing, angry blood. Carefully, she reached up and delicately touched the back of her head. There was a lump forming there, another to the left side of her face, and some cuts across her face, dried blood in her hair. She had suffered a beating, she realized. She thought back, pushing through the heavy curtain of unwilling memory, recalling Brigid turning on her. Grant grabbing her wrist as she tried to defend herself. She remembered how Grant had turned on her in the bedroom. She scrunched her eyes shut tight for a moment, wishing away the memory, bringing her mind back to the present. She opened her eyes and looked at the wall ahead, feeling the force against her knees, even through the soft bed of discarded food and waste that she rested on. Ahead of her, the wall was moving. No, not the wall. The platform beneath her was moving, gradually along the wall, heading toward the right where she had noticed the drop-off edge. Worried now, Shizuka hauled herself up. Flashes of pain burned through her muscles like acid as she stood. She was in some sort of recycling plant, she realized now. Standing, she could see the grinding metal teeth at the end of the conveyor belt devouring food scraps. With only the flat wall ahead, Shizuka looked around her until she spied the walkway with its thin safety rails, a gap where things were tipped onto the slow-moving belt. Sizing it up, she guessed that it was 10 feet above the surface of the conveyor belt. With effort, she would be able to reach it. As she took a step forward, her bare foot sank into the mulch of the food detritus. From where she lay, a glint caught her eye. There was her katana, its hilt and the first 2 inches of blade sticking up from a pile of trash a few steps closer to the trash compactor. And next to it, half-sunken into the mush, she saw the operations worker Trent, face pale, eyes closed, tongue sticking out of the corner of his mouth.
What have I stumbled onto?
Stairwell D led into the corridor to the machine room's south entrance. The overhead lighting within the corridor was dull. Domi held up a hand and signaled for Lakesh to hold back while she investigated. Lakesh watched from the ajar fire door as the albino girl moved forward in a semi-crouch. She reached down and unsheathed one of the blades that she wore strapped to her boots, and its burnished steel edge glinted occasionally as she walked beneath the lights that were affixed to the cold concrete walls. The corridor was empty, and Domi walked across to another fire door at the far end. She carefully peeked into the stairwell, but it was empty. She edged back until she stood before the machine room's door. Her chalk-white hand moved through the air like a dove taking flight, gesturing to Lakesh to join her. Right now, Domi didn't like the idea of the man being too far from where she could protect him.
Follow me in, and wait immediately inside, okay?
Lakesh nodded, still clutching the rebreather to his face. In silence, Domi counted down with her fingers. With Lakesh directly behind her, Domi stepped inside. She remained at the door for a moment, hunkering down, the knife held out before her. The atmosphere was noticeably heavier here, despite the air being completely clear to the eye. Domi's crimson eyes scanned the large room, searching for a foe. She crouched lower, placing one hand on the floor as she looked for the telltale appearance of feet beneath the wide pipes. Still bent over, she moved swiftly, like a rabbit scampering across the room, as she checked left and right for any sign of enemies. Lakesh watched, amazed at Domi's speed, the economy of movement as she covered the main walkways of the room. She then rejoined Lakesh at the door, slipping the knife back into its sheath.
No one here except a corpse.
A corpse?
Engineer, I think. Tucked underneath, piped by big machine.
The main intake unit? Can we take a look? Is it safe, dearest heart?
We can take a look. Safe? Not so sure.
Lakesh walked beside Domi across the vast room, ducking beneath pipes as they made their way to the main intake unit. As he approached it, Domi pointed across and down, and Lakesh saw the glint of something on the floor sticking out from one of the wide pipes that traversed the room. He bent closer and saw that it was a gold ring on the stubby finger of a man's hand. The wrist and arm disappeared beneath a thick pipe, and Lakesh knelt to peer more closely. The hand belonged to Benjamin Michaels, an unassuming engineer who had been with Cerberus since the influx of personnel from the Menetius moon base. The man had been a thoughtful, diligent worker, Lakesh knew, but he couldn't say much more about him than that. Now he lay beneath a cooling pipe, a wound in his skull, and streaks of blood dried across his face. He just did his job, Lakesh thought, and it looks very much like that was enough to get him murdered.
Mo!
Lakesh turned and saw that she was standing beside the front panel of the tall intake unit.
What is it?
Look!
Domi pointed to the front panel and drew a rough circle in the air with her finger. Lakesh peered more closely, cursing that the lighting in this room was not better, and then he saw the indentation. It looked as if something hard had been hammered against the side of the unit, and that someone had taken it upon themselves to provide a quick makeshift repair to the metallic fascia.
Any idea what happened? Belay that.
He straightened his legs and walked across to the dented front panel. Lakesh ran his fingertips along the sides of the panel, where rivets held it against the churning ventilation unit.
Someone's tampered with this. The front panel has been removed and replaced, and they weren't delicate about it either. This was a quick and dirty job. Michaels over there probably stumbled upon this unauthorized bit of maintenance, and whoever was doing it was thoroughly ruthless in keeping him quiet.
Domi was kneeling beside the body of Michaels now, and she touched his hand with her fingertips for just a moment.
He's cold. Must have been some time ago. Fingers are stiffening.
Lakesh looked at the dented front plate of the processor.
We'll need to get this open. Whatever you can sense is very likely inside.
Domi nodded, stepping away from the corpse beneath the pipes to help Lakesh. With her feet sinking into the food waste beneath her, Shizuka gradually made her way across the conveyor belt to where Trent's body lay. It was an effort moving through the piles of trash, like walking in quicksand, her every step sinking into its mass, the trash oozing around her, trying to lock her feet in place. Shizuka's nose wrinkled as she knelt on the trash, feeling the sticky gunk push against the bare skin of her exposed legs where the brief length of the silk dressing gown ended.
Trent! Trent!
Trent didn't react. The man looked to be dead, but Shizuka couldn't be sure. Girding herself, Shizuka's long fingers brushed the skin of the man's cheek, feeling the warmth there, seeing his body flinch in reaction.
Please wake up. We have to get out of here.
Shizuka shifted her position on the pile of trash, reaching across to pull her katana from where it was embedded in the foul-smelling detritus. Still kneeling, she eyeballed the metal of the blade. It looked fine, sharp and true, despite the caking of discarded food that had adhered to it. Shizuka took up a corner of her short dressing gown and carefully ran it along the razor-sharp blade to clean the worst of the debris from its surface. She took a moment to hold the shining surface of the blade before her and inspected her reflection. Like the blade, she was speckled with splashes of blood and food. She could clean the blade and herself properly later. Right now, she had work to do if she and Trent were to get out of here alive. Shifting her weight amid the stinking garbage pile, Shizuka pushed herself to a standing position and looked across to the high walkway once more. It was 10 feet above her, that was all. It was nothing she couldn't reach with a little jump. She held the familiar weight of the sword in her right hand, pointing outward like a tightrope walker's pole to help her balance as she made her way across the slush-like mounds of litter toward the side of the conveyor belt where it abutted the filth-stained wall.
Damn it, Trent, wake up!
Still wearing the rebreather, Domi went over to one of the exit doors of the machinery room, where a fire axe with a red handle and a red stripe of paint across its blade resided behind the window of a glass cabinet. The old cabinet was either locked or sealed with age. Like almost everything else in the redoubt, the Cerberus fire safety equipment had waited patiently for more than 200 years until being called upon. Domi removed one of the blades that she wore against her shin, then reversed it in her hand. She reached inside and plucked the axe from the brackets that held it there. The axe featured a small, heavy head atop its long handle, and it struck Domi as a poorly balanced tool, certainly of no use in combat. The handle stretched almost the full height of the petite woman's torso, from shoulder to groin, and having sheathed her knife, she held the fire axe in a two-handed grip as she made her way back to where Lakesh waited, beside the large intake unit that dominated the room.
Can opener.
She handed the long-handled axe to her lover. Lakesh took the axe, adjusting his grip as he familiarized himself with its weight and heft. Standing before the dented metal plate at the front of the air filtration unit, Lakesh brought the axe over his shoulder.
Yeah, again!
Conveyor belt moved Shizuka another few feet toward the grinding wheels at its edge, and she steadied her balance, bending her knees a little to ensure that she wouldn't fall. Once the belt was still, Shizuka stood at the side nearest to the overhead walkway, the same one that she had been tossed from by the counterfeit Grant just a few hours before. Her head was still pounding, ears ringing, but she focused her concentration, ignoring the pain and considering how to reach the platform. It was just 10 feet above the surface of the conveyor belt, less than 5 feet above the top of her head. Shizuka reached up, stretching her left arm, the empty hand straining against the grimy wall. The wall was smooth, its surface slimy with the remnants of discarded food and drinks. It shouldn't be difficult to make the climb. She would just need a little run up so that she could kick out and jump. Once up there, she could assist Trent, find a rope, or work the controls to shut down the system. She was a highly competent athlete, a phenomenal fighter. She had achieved more demanding jumps than this. Shizuka stepped back a pace, her heel dragging through the oozing junk beneath her, and she foresaw a problem. With the unsteady surface below her, the sinking, clinging, quicksand-like mounds of trash that supported her and threatened to engulf her, getting any kind of run-up for a jump would be next to impossible. She tried pushing down against the trash below her. If she kept pushing, the trash would keep giving. It could be another 3 feet before she reached the actual surface of the conveyor belt itself. It may be 5 or 6 feet, more than Shizuka's height, and if that was the case, she would end up burying herself before she ever got the chance to make the jump. Shizuka pulled her sinking foot from the trash and took a step backward onto slightly more solid ground. She stood there, eyeing the overhanging walkway once more. There was a very real possibility, she realized to her horror, that she simply would not be able to get up high enough to reach it. Once Lakesh had loosened the front panel using the fire axe, Domi helped him remove the panel so that they could properly look inside the processing unit. Even in the dim lighting of the shadow-filled machine room, Domi spotted the first canister immediately, tucked a little way back among the network of cooling pipes, the yellow transfers on its side designed to catch the light despite the shadows all around. Lakesh's hand went automatically to the rebreather mask that he had strapped across his mouth and nose, ensuring it was secure as he poked his head amid the pipes to look more closely at the canister.
Phosgene, this is a pulmonary agent.
Not good?
There was a strange smell in the air now, like fresh hay or cut grass, a freshness, but also a pressure, something that clung to one's air tracts like a heavy fog.
It's a choking agent. They used it as far back as the trenches in World War I.
Lakesh looked across and spied a second canister, shoved a little way back into the processing unit, its lid also removed.
There are at least two of them, and we have to prepare ourselves for the very real possibility of more.
This stuff travels through the air. How much would it take to kill someone?
Not much.
Where would someone get this from? How did they get it in here without anyone noticing?
Lakesh ducked out of the unit, lugging the first phosgene canister with him, bringing it away from the pipes and into the light.
This has our storage barcode on it. It is an inside job. Somebody on our team is trying to kill us.
So what do we do now?
It's already in the ventilation system. We have to evacuate Cerberus.
Bridget held Abigail's hand tightly as they followed Magistrate Kane along the corridor of the Cobaltville Medical Hub. Abby's movements were sluggish, and she had yawned several times on the way over. Bridget tried her best not to worry herself about the girl. If she and Kane were right, then there were much more significant things to occupy her mind right now than how tired her niece was feeling. Kane stopped outside a door marked 17.
This is it, Baptiste.
Bridget looked up and down the corridor until she saw a grouping of comfortable chairs a little way down from the next door along.
Abby, can you be a big girl and wait on those chairs for me?
Okay, Auntie Bridget.
Seems like a good kid.
She is. I hate for her to get mixed up in all this. She's scared enough already.
It isn't going to matter if she hears, you know. Not if we're right.
I know, but old habits die hard. And I love her, Kane.
Within the room, Bridget saw a hulking, dark-skinned man lying face up on a high bed, gazing out the window of the darkened room. The shades were open, and the night lights of Cobaltville played across the room. Bridget looked at the man, unfamiliar as he was, saw the mound of his body that was hidden by the sheets, and flinched when she realized how its length ceased just past his waist.
This is my partner, Magistrate Grant. Grant, meet Bridget Baptiste.
He turned to look at her then, and saw the vibrant red hair like flames framing her porcelain face.
Ah, the redhead.
You two have spoken about me, I guess.
A little. Kane tell you his theory?
We discussed it.
Baptiste has some insight into this that may help us, Grant.
I've been thinking about it myself, but why don't you kids go first?
Bridget pulled a seat over and sat beside Grant's bed.
I have a very specific memory trait known by some as eidetic. You'd probably know it better by its popular term, a photographic memory.
I didn't think that really existed.
It's rare, but not unheard of. Statistically, young children are especially prone to display the ability of perfect recall, but most of them lose that talent as they get older. I happen to be a rare exception.
And this helps us how?
This is the only world I've ever known. It seems real and solid. It fits every memory that I have. But my subconscious has been sending me messages for the past 2 days. Messages that suggest that the whole thing is a lie.
The whole thing?
The structures of perception have broken down, Magistrate Grant. And it's my belief that our interpretations of the world around us can no longer be trusted.
Kane thinks we're in a prison. He tell you that?
He had me pegged for one of the jailers. But I'm not. Not so far as I know, at least.
So here's what I've been thinking. There's a woman here, a nurse called Elaine, and she's very attractive. I mean, she would be any man's dream. The woman practically threw herself at me, a messed up, crippled mag with a bad attitude. Just threw herself at me.
Your point, partner?
Dreams, Kane. The dream girl, the whole thing. I think we're dreaming.
That's crazy.
No, it's not. The whole setup works with dream logic. Me and the nurse, the job, you and what, Kane?
His mother.
Ms. Baptiste here and...
Abigail, my niece.
Dreams and desire. We all get what we want.
But how do we all dream the same dream?
It's impossible for two minds to dream the same dream.
It's not our dream. We're players in someone else's dream, and we're being played too.
Whose dream?
Right now, the dreamer is the closest thing to a supreme being, to God, that we have.
Trapped in a God dream. This is not good.
We can't see the waking edges of the dream, but we know they must be there. We just need to find them.
In silence, the three of them considered Grant's speculations. As they quietly pondered, turning the idea over in their heads, Abigail entered the room.
Auntie Bridget, can we go home yet? I'm really yawny.
Bridget looked at the cherubic girl as she came over to rest her head on her lap.
I know, Munchkin, we're all tired. Won't be very long now, I promise.
Abby rested against Bridget's legs and gazed at the man in the bed.
What happened to that man?
Shh, Abby, it's okay. This is Grant. He's our friend.
What happened?
We're not sure.
At the side of the room, Kane pushed the remaining two chairs together.
Why doesn't Abigail lie down here?
What do you say, Abby?
Okay.
Bridget sat with her, silently watching the lights twinkling through the window, stroking Abby's hair until the girl fell asleep.
What are we going to do?
Bridget looked up at him and Grant, her sleeping niece's head resting on her lap.
I don't want to leave.
Are you crazy, Baptiste? What the hell do you mean you don't want to leave?
I have everything I could ever want, right here. Why would I leave?
Because it's a trap. Because we've been stuck inside some kind of dream cage.
But what if this isn't a prison? Maybe this is our reward for everything we've done in that other world. Maybe this is heaven. Did you ever think about that, Magistrate?
Maybe you're right,
but it's not real.
Does that matter? It feels real enough. Your mother feels real, right, Kane?
Kane was silent, Grant's eyes fixed on his partner.
Kane?
I need to think about this.
What's to think about? If we're right, then it's not real. It's just smoke and mirrors.
Did you ever regret waking up from a dream, Grant? Ever find yourself wishing you could just go back to sleep and return to it?
Now, Baptiste here, I get. She's got a daughter.
Niece.
Niece, then. But you? What do you have here, Kane? As long as there's a never-ending supply of perps to catch and you can have lunch with your dead mom every now and then, you'll be happy? Is that really what you think?
But what did we come from, Grant? What did we escape from? War? Plague? Something worse? What if we chose to come here? What if we're not the only ones who chose this life? What if we're the only ones who suspect there was ever anything else?
What if we break down the gates of heaven and find we can't get back in?
You came to me with this, Kane. You came to me with your suspicions, and you made me doubt everything.
I'm sorry.
Kane turned and left the room. Bridget looked at the magistrate lying in the bed before her.
I'm sorry too, Magistrate. I think I should be going. Abby should be in her own bed.
Yeah, well, we all should. But unless we fight this, we'll never get to be in our own beds ever again, Ms. Baptiste. Isn't that the point?
I know.
Bridget carefully lifted Abby from the chairs, cradling her in her arms as she made her way to the exit.
This whole place is wrong.
In the real world, in another cave within the vast complex of the original tribe, Cloudsinger stood before the council elders as they listened to her plea from behind their battered and worn wooden table. Many years before, the long table had served in a bar, and its rich, dark surface still showed the rings where wet glasses had been left upon it for too long.
Everything is in place to destroy Cerberus.
The elders looked at her with piercing eyes until she shrank a little, taking a half-step backward. Behind her, Broken Ghost waited in the shadows, having agreed to listen to the plea but making no promises to contribute. Broken Ghost considered this an irrelevance. The campaign was already in motion, the endgame approaching fast. They did not need their movements to be sanctioned by the Elder Council now. It was a warrior's right to avenge his or her war brothers. The eldest of the council, a man with an age-lined face and a patchy gray beard that fell down to his little pot belly, studied Cloudsinger.
The tribe must always strive to remake the world, to better it for everyone, Cloudsinger. Can you assure me that your actions will do this?
Cerberus stands in the way of that goal. They have interfered before in our plans to retrieve the death cry.
The council is aware of this.
They stood against my field team when we went to retrieve the death cry. We lost our best warriors, and we failed to secure the weapon itself.
Which makes this sound like a revenge mission. The original tribe must hold themselves above such things, girl.
Cloudsinger stood still, aware that all eyes were upon her, unable to think of what to say. And then the assassin, Broken Ghost, stepped forward.
The actions of the service personnel on that day infected the Dreamin'. In 6 weeks, it'll be unusable. They're like a rabid dog, snapping at the tribe's heels without any comprehension of the damage that they do. If we don't destroy the dog, it will become an insurmountable obstacle to our happiness and to our overall mission, the betterment of humankind.
Your point is well made, Broken Ghost. We wish you success in your endeavor, Cloudsinger.
Thank you.
Cloudsinger bowed once to the council. Then she turned on her heel and joined Broken Ghost as the assassin led the way from the cave.
And thank you as well, Ghost.
Broken Ghost looked at her, the skull face drawn over her own like a specter. Together, they paced through the tunnels, past the flickering torches that lit the passages within the rock.
Whatever they'd said, It wouldn't have made a difference. The project's too near completion to halt now. I say what I said to smooth things over, but when we return, nothing more. You walk the assassin's path now, Cloudsinger.
But you accepted the task from me as soon as I approached you. Why?
When Baird Father died, I lost my mentor and my patron. The Council has always feared me, but he did not. Thus, without him, I have no mission.
Then why didn't you join us when we went to the mountain range in Russia to retrieve the death cry?
Because, if I had gone, I would have done so alone.
Bridget Baptiste stood in the lounge of her apartment, replacing the ornaments that had fallen from the shelves during her struggle with Magistrate Kane just a few hours before. Abigail was fast asleep in Bridget's bed, the door pulled closed, not so much to allow the girl her privacy as to prevent Bridget's anxious movements from keeping her awake. It was strange, she realized, walking about an apartment that may not even exist. She knelt, picking up the shattered pieces of a vase that had skittered under the couch during the fracas. Bridget took the pieces, placing them carefully in her open palm.
I don't know what's real anymore. I don't even know if I'm real.
Home again, Kane pressed the play button on his comm unit before he made his way to the fridge.
Good morning, Kane.
He checked his wrist chron automatically, seeing it was almost 2 o'clock a.m., it had turned into a hell of a long day. He reached for the jug of cooled fruit juice in the refrigerator.
You have no new messages. You have one old message. Received yesterday at 10.07 p.m. Playing. Kane, darling, are you there? No? I guess you must still be working. I was just calling to see if we could move our lunch date an hour forward tomorrow. Nothing important, just some new shipment coming to the gallery that Jeff wants me to evaluate. So I need to be back before 3 o'clock.
Kane walked over and peered at the tiny screen of the comm. The beautiful woman was shrugging as though the whole thing was ludicrous.
Well, anyway, I'll be at the cafe at 12:30, okay? I'll see you there, I hope. Let me know if it's a problem.
She paused then, and Kane watched as her hand reached toward the screen to disconnect the communication. She stopped and looked back at the screen, her beautiful, chocolate-rich eyes peering into the camera lens that captured her image.
Don't forget how proud of you I am. I couldn't ask for a better son.
Abruptly, the picture disappeared.
Message ends. No further messages.
Kane stood by the comm, still clutching the jug of juice as he peered at the blank screen.
Maybe Baptiste is right. Everything we want is here.
Sitting on the dilapidated couch, Kane pressed play once again on the answer comm, feeling empty inside.
But it's not enough.
Kane, darling, are you there?
Swiftly, Lakesh and Domi rushed up the concrete stairs to the main floor of the Cerberus Redoubt. Domi led the way into the wide corridor that led to the operations room. When Lakesh exited the stairwell, Domi was well ahead of him, hunkering down, knife in hand, as she checked the doorways and junctions that peeled from the main thoroughfare.
It's safe, but it's empty. There's no one around.
Lakesh checked his wrist chron as he followed Domi. It was almost 4 a.m., so the lack of personnel was not especially remarkable. The facility was supposedly enjoying some downtime between operations, and Lakesh had seen no reason to keep the facility staff on high alert. In light of the discovery in the air conditioning unit, Lakesh was beginning to curse that laxness. But if, as he suspected, it was an inside job, then no amount of vigilance would have protected Cerberus. The dead body of Michaels proved that their enemy or enemies were ruthless and utterly without mercy. Domi had helped him remove the deadly canisters from the air conditioner, but it was impossible to guess how much had already leaked into the system, was even now being inhaled by his staff. They had to evacuate the redoubt first, then they had to access the mainframe in order to shut down and cleanse the ventilation systems. Domi held up her hand, silently instructing Lakesh to wait once more as her blood-red eyes scanned the corridor before she peered into the ops room itself. Inside, the room was illuminated with a warm, cozy glow from the subtle side lights. Two staff members sat at their desks, monitoring the incoming feeds and checking that the systems remained working as normal. Domi turned back to Lakesh, encouraging him inside. Farrell, a shaven-headed man wearing a neatly trimmed goatee beard above a wide mouth and a single gold hoop earring, turned as the pair entered. His eyes widened when he saw that the two of them wore rebreather masks, and he pushed back from his desk and rushed over to talk with Lakesh.
What's going on?
Lakesh peered over, recognizing the blonde-haired woman at the communications desk.
There's a chemical agent in the atmosphere, Mr. Farrell. I want you and Delaney to clear out and head straight to the main exit immediately.
Beth Delaney looked up at the sound of her name and realized that something odd was going on.
What's happened?
Evac protocol. I'm issuing the order now.
Lakesh pulled the tiny earpiece and mic headset from his desk and flipped on the public address system. A green light glowed, and Lakesh pulled down his gas mask.
Attention all Cerberus personnel. This is Dr. Singh. I am ordering an immediate evacuation of the redoubt. This is not a drill. I repeat, this is not a drill.
His finger jabbed at the PA control once more, and the green light faded back to a dull amber. Lakesh then entered a brief security code into the master control on his desk, and the lights in the ops room switched to a reddish-orange. Domi stood by the door, watching as Farrell and Delaney walked swiftly out of the ops room and briskly made their way down the main corridor. The corridor, like the ops room, had switched to red lighting, and pulsing white lights lit the edges of the wide walkway, indicating the direction of strategic withdrawal.
You too, Domi.
Lakesh looked at her, the rebreather hanging around his neck.
Whatever's happened here, I need everyone out of the facility, and that includes you.
I'll leave when you do.
Domi, dearest, this is an order. I have to be the last to leave. Basic protocol. But I want to be sure that you are safe.
Domi tapped a chalk-white finger against the rebreather she wore over her features.
Right now, I'm safer than you are, and I'm not going anywhere unless you're with me. One, it's no more dangerous for me to be here than it is for you. Two, I just know you'll get yourself into a wagload of trouble if I'm not watching your back.
Lakesh simply reached his hand out, clenching hers.
Thank you. Now, if you're staying, perhaps you can run a diagnostics check on our HVAC system. See how much phosgene has infiltrated it and whether we can flush it out.
Domi stepped across to the nearest computer terminal. Lakesh was quietly surprised to see her work at the computer without a word of complaint. It certainly wasn't her preferred activity. Taking his seat at his own terminal, Lakesh entered the security code that would grant him access to the mainframe. After a few moments, Domi peered across to him, her brow creased with worry.
I can't get access.
Allow me.
He rushed past the subroutine menus and brought up a live monitor feed of the air filtration system. An alien contaminant was clearly identified on the three-dimensional map of the ventilation system. Abruptly, the screen went blank, and after a second's delay, a stream of data made up of apparently random numbers and letters rushed before Lakesh's eyes.
What?
Same thing's happening here. Something's wrong with the system.
Bother.
Lakesh felt the sinking feeling in his stomach. Whoever their mysterious enemy was, they had done something to the Cerberus mainframe. Below them, in the recycling room, Shizuka stood on the conveyor belt, glaring at the walkway above her. She had made several unsuccessful attempts to clamber up the side of the wall to the overhanging walkway, and all of them had ended with her sinking back into the festering trash. The walkway was so close, and yet remained frustratingly out of her reach. She needed something sturdy that would act as a scaffold, a climbing frame. If she timed her next attempt between the erratic movements of the conveyor belt, the frame should stay in place long enough for her to be free of the relentless recycling operation. She looked around, her eyes scanning for something solid amid the mulch. Trent's body still lay face up, eyes still closed. The unfortunate man was sinking into the trash. The back of his head had already disappeared, and the trash had almost reached to his earlobes. As Shizuka watched, the conveyor belt began to move, edging Trent's unconscious form closer to the grinding teeth. This was it, Shizuka realized suddenly. With this push, the conveyor belt would toss Trent's sleeping form over the edge where the blades would begin their butcher's work. The man deserved better than that. On light feet, Shizuka dashed across the moving, sludge-like mess. Lakesh's primary discipline was cybernetics. Domi watched as his fingers tapped at the keyboard, employing all of his skills as he accessed the Cerberus operating system and hunted down the cause of the system-wide error.
Somebody's set up a rootkit. It's taken control of the mainframe and is aborting any conventional attempts to access our hardware.
That's bad.
Given time, I can work around it. If I hadn't just given the evacuation order, I'd ask Donald or Skylar to help. Perhaps Bridget.
Domi moved to the main door of the room. She watched the evacuating personnel as they trudged along the red-lit corridor. There was no pushing or shoving, no sense of panic. The Cerberus staff understood the need to evacuate in an orderly manner.
Donald's up front. Looks like he's counting people off on a chart.
Good old Donald.
Should I go grab him?
No. Let him get on with his job. The personnel come before the facility, Domi. Computers can be replaced.
As Domi watched the crowds marching through the corridor, a side door opened at the emergency stairwell and Bridget stepped out. Her red-gold hair seemed to glow in the altered lighting as she watched the exiting crowds for a few moments. She then looked in Domi's direction, a grim look on her face.
Bridget, come here, we need you.
A moment later, Bridget began walking toward the ops room.
Domi? Lakesh? What's going on? What's with the masks?
Lakesh glanced up from his work at the terminal, his face set in a frown.
Bridget, thank you for joining us. I could use your assistance right now.
Bridget stood beside Lakesh, peering at his screen while Domi pulled a spare rebreather mask from one of the room's equipment lockers and passed it to her.
Someone's attacking Cerberus. The attack is coming from multiple angles, and more worryingly, it appears to be an inside job.
Bridget slipped the mask over her face.
How can I help?
They've put a pulmonary agent into the ventilation system. We should be able to flush the system clean once the personnel are evacuated, but right now I can't access any of the commands. Someone has set a rootkit program on the mainframe. It's acting as administrator, overriding anything I try to do. Right now, I can't even get a status report.
I'll see what I can do.
Decimal River ran through the readings that were scrolling across his computer screen.
The gateway's secure.
Grimly, Broken Ghost turned to Cloudsinger and smiled, a hideous thing within the skull-like makeup of her face.
It's time to go.
Cloudsinger felt elated, but she simply nodded once, hiding her joy from the older woman. It seemed right then that she had been waiting forever for this moment, when she would finally see Lakesh dead. She watched as Broken Ghost stripped off the loose shirt she wore, revealing her toned body. Broken Ghost reached down and unclipped the bull roarer from its place at her belt, judging its weight in her hands. Without a word, she strode out of the cave, and Cloudsinger followed her, feeling the weight of the boomerang that she had strapped to her own waist, ready for the coming battle. As soon as Lakesh had given the evacuation order, the Cerberus personnel had been awakened from sleep or alerted at whatever task they were doing, and all of them made their way to the main corridor to exit the structure by the large accordion-style door. Shock-haired Donald Bry had brought a list of personnel with him, and he counted people as they passed him on their way to the exit, ticking them off to ensure that everyone escaped unharmed. After the main evacuation was finished, Bry would head back to the operations room and see who remained. He didn't doubt that Lakesh would be the last to leave. The general hubbub from the throng rose, and Bry looked up from his checklist to see what was going on. He could see that the door at the far end of the corridor was still closed, despite his issuing the order almost 3 minutes ago that it be opened to its widest extent. A well-muscled ex-mag called Edwards peered up from the control panel. Edwards had styled his hair into a severe crew cut that showed off a bullet-bitten right ear, and he wore a tight undershirt that left his powerful arms exposed. Bry noticed the concern on the ex-mag's face immediately.
What's wrong, Edwards?
I can't get it open!
Edwards held the little panel open, showing Bry the controls. Bry entered the unlock code, but nothing happened.
You see?
Pushing his thumbnail into the groove at the bottom of the little panel, Donald flipped off the fascia and peered inside.
Well, the wiring appears to be intact. I wonder what's stopping it.
You want to wonder a bit quicker, Brainiac? I think the natives are getting restless.
Peering over his shoulder, Bry saw the waiting people watching him, peering at the control panel.
No need to panic, folks. Just be a minute.
Bry turned back to the controls, wondering what on earth he was going to do. Standing amid the crowd, Kane smiled as he watched the concerned faces around him as Bry took a tiny screwdriver to the security plate and began dismantling the unit. The conveyor belt trundled onward, dumping its next load of trash over the edge of the rollers and into the blades below. Shizuka was beside Trent now, and she pushed the sleeve of her ruined silk dressing gown back as she reached for the man's arm, grabbing him just above the wrist.
Wake up!
Then she yanked, trying to pull Trent free of the sludge-like detritus that his body had sunk into. He was stuck fast, and Shizuka knew she would need both hands to pull the man loose. As the conveyor belt moved relentlessly onward, Shizuka turned the katana in her hand so that it faced downward like a walking stick. Then she rammed the blade hard into the festering trash. With both hands now free, Shizuka took a firm grip on Trent's arm and tried to pull again, but it was no use. The man was sinking deeper into the trash, and Shizuka realized so was she. The more she tried to secure her footing, the more force she exerted and the farther she sank into the gunk beneath her. Shizuka placed a strong two-handed grip on Trent's right ankle. But Trent's body still wouldn't budge. Already, the damp, slimy trash was oozing over her ankles, washing against the bottoms of her shins. Shizuka let go of the man's leg and fell back as she tried to pull her feet free. The clump of food waste before her, where Trent's unconscious body was embedded, reached the rounded edge of the conveyor belt, and Shizuka turned her face away as she waited for the inevitable. Shizuka opened her eyes and peered at the rolling edge of the conveyor belt as she moved toward it. Trent was compost, and she was next. They walked, just the two of them, for a few minutes. Broken Ghost's hands holding the Dream Slicer, wrapping its cord over her knuckles, familiarizing herself to its weight once more. They passed the huts of the tribe's village, continued to the edge of the settlement, to the special area that had been marked out in pebbles. The area showed two rings, one large and one small, and Broken Ghost walked across the center of the larger ring and stopped.
Do you need me to go into the other ring?
Normally, the leader of the dream journey would take point in the small ring, and the strike team would be lifted into the dreaming from their positions in the larger circle.
It's just ritual. Stand where you will.
Dressed in her blood-dyed strips, Cloudsinger stood across from the assassin, placing her arms around herself to stave off the night's chill.
I'm ready.
Without a word, Broken Ghost began spinning the bull roarer. In the back of her head, at the top of her spinal cord, Cloud Singer felt the bubbling, brushing sensation as the Dream Slicer's song engaged her subcutaneous implant. Shizuka squirmed amid the stinking, rotting trash, desperately trying to free herself as the conveyor belt unstoppably headed for the drop that would toss her fragile form into the crushing blades. Her own weight, light though she was acting against her, dragging her down into the quagmire of decaying garbage. She kicked her feet out, watching as just 3 feet from her bare toes, scraps of food fell over the curve of the moving belt, plummeted into the blades that waited below. Shizuka clawed at the moving, spongy mound beneath her, trying desperately to free herself. With one leg free, she plunged her hands into the mound of trash which held her. Both legs free now, the samurai warrior dived away from the edge, rising from a crawl to a crouched walk as the conveyor belt shook beneath her. Her right hand reached back, clasping the long hilt of her katana where she had left it buried in the trash, and she whipped it free as she hurried ahead, creating more and more distance between herself and those relentless, grinding blades. Moving swiftly, her tread deliberately light, Shizuka trotted over the mounds of trash that threatened to pull her under. Standing with sword in hand, Shizuka steadied herself as the surface beneath her ceased to move and vibrate. She had been granted a reprieve as the belt made one of its automatic stops, a temporary one, to allow the grinding teeth to catch up with the job of pulverizing the trash. She needed to find a way out of there, and quickly, before she ended up as much minced meat as the unfortunate Trent. Once again, Shizuka stared at the stained, grease-slick, and seemingly insurmountable wall and wondered what she was going to do. Cloudsinger and Broken Ghost stepped into the void, walking the in-between. To Cloudsinger's eyes, the dreaming was as beautiful as ever, with its fresh fields and verdant valleys. A map of Australia that teemed with life, with energy and excitement so unlike the outback of real world, with its poisonous creatures that lurked beneath the dust, ready to pounce on their unsuspecting victims. Above them, the white clouds swirled through the sapphire blue sky as Cloudsinger and her colleague walked away from the two rings that had been marked out in pebbles on the ground. Her eyes, slits, the assassin looked back at the girl, her hand rocking back and forth above her head as she whirled the bull roarer. Cloudsinger felt the tingling pull at her nape, the implant firing again and again, holding her in the dreaming, that world of secret pathways that only the original tribe knew. The dreaming was the world wrought in imaginings, carved from belief. It was a place to visit, as their ancestors had visited it for more than 1,000 years. When good father and bad father were young, they had been explorers and thieves. They had found an old Australian military facility, long abandoned, much of it wrecked. Within, they had found the singing circuit that allowed access to other places. It was a similar system to the Matrans that had been developed in America. A teleportation system that allowed personnel to travel vast distances in the blink of an eye. When good father and bad father stepped into the teleport warp, however, they realized that it was something more. This was not merely a device to go from A to B. But here was something to access the places in between, the places that their ancestors had explored again and again in their ritual dreams. Accessing the portal to slice the dream required a receiver unit implanted into a traveler's spinal column. This circuit acted in conjunction with the ululating tone of the dream slicer to allow an individual access to the dreaming world. Once in the dreaming, that individual had access to everywhere else. Or that was the way it had worked, until Cerberus, in its jealousy, had unleashed the death cry into the dreaming, eating it from the inside out. There had been other technologies, too. Things grafted onto the warrior cast to make them stronger, faster, to allow them night vision and swifter reactions. Cloudsinger had first undergone surgery at age 5, and she could still remember the burning sensations that had run through her body as it had been laced with the first traces of circuitry. Once one had experienced the pain of that nature so very, very early in life, it was hard to imagine a life without pain. Broken Ghost took a step backward, feet crossing as Cloudsinger watched. Then, in the blink of an eye, the assassin who moved like a ghost disappeared, a cloud of dust, all that remained of her passing. To follow, Cloudsinger stretched her arms out to her sides and opened her mouth. The note was pure, but it would only ever be heard within the dreaming itself. It was a note constructed only of belief. As the note continued, Cloudsinger rose from the ground, arms outstretched, head up and facing forward, her body held at a 30-degree angle with the long, outstretched beauty of a swan's neck. And then, holding the wonderful note, she rocketed through the sky, chasing Broken Ghost across the multicolored dreamscape. As former Menetius Moonbase geologist Mariah Falk waited among the crowd for Donald Bry to open the main door, she spotted Kane close to the stairwell. Being a tall man with the posture of a magistrate, he seemed to loom over the other Cerberus personnel. Mariah waved to him, but he seemed oblivious, watching the progress at the door with narrowed eyes. She pushed her way through the crowd toward him.
Kane, any idea what's going on?
Kane's blue-gray eyes flicked to Mariah, and she saw him smile.
Mariah Falk, how are you?
Just about awake. What's with this 4 a.m. evac?
Kane's eyes went back to the action at the far end of the corridor, where Bry and Edwards were dismantling the keypad.
Darned if I know. Looks like there's a glitch with the lock.
So we're sealed inside?
Could be.
And that doesn't scare you, Kane?
A man shouldn't be scared of dying, Mariah. Not if it's for the right cause.
With those words, the ex-mag made a path along the wall, heading back toward the ops room.
Dying?
Mariah watched him go, wondering why he seemed so sure of himself, almost looking pleased while the other members of the Cerberus personnel were becoming increasingly restless. Lakesh peered across to the terminal where Bridget Baptiste worked, hoping she might have found a way to bypass the rootkit.
Anything, Bridget?
Bridget's mop of red hair swung back and forth as she shook her head.
Nothing yet. The whole system is riddled with this thing like a cancer. It's taken control of the administrator functions, which means it instantly overrides anything we try to do from here. Sorry, Lakesh, but I think this one's beyond my computing skills.
You're right. We need one of the IT experts in here right away. Domi, find Donald Bry or Skylar Hitch, or preferably both of them.
Right.
Domi entered the corridor once more and was surprised to see that the crowd was still waiting there. The corridors of Cerberus always felt cool, but she detected no breeze coming from the large entrance door at the far end. That was strange. Domi headed toward the milling crowd. As she walked along the corridor, she saw Kane striding directly toward her, head down, determined.
Kane, what's going on? Why are people still inside the building?
Door's broken.
Shit! Look, there's something in the air, some contaminant. We need to get these people gas masks if they're staying inside, right away!
I'll get some.
Domi watched as the broad-shouldered man continued striding along the corridor in the direction she had just come from.
Be careful! Something's going on, Kane! Something bad!
Shizuka's ears were still ringing, and the ache at the back of her head nagged at her from the beating she had suffered at the hands of the phony Grant and Bridget. But the throbbing was gradually subsiding. At last, she was finding that she could think more clearly. The stench in the vast recycling room beneath the Cerberus Redoubt assaulted her nostrils, and the heat was close, oppressive. She wished the air conditioning in the room would kick in, little realizing the irony of such a desire. Sword in hand, she walked across the uneven surface of trash that congealed on the conveyor belt, sure that there had to be some way of scaling the slick wall, if only she could keep her thoughts clear enough to see it. The wall was pitted here and there, but the notches were small, hardly enough to act as proper hand or footholds. The trash mound beneath her had too much give. If she applied pressure, she just sank deeper into it and lost height rather than gaining it, pushing her target farther away, like something from a bad dream. There was nothing in the piles of rotting garbage that she might use, either to stop the whirring blades or to act as a ladder. Not even something to provide her with just a single step up so that she might spring to safety. As the thought struck her, the corners of her mouth raised in an enigmatic smile, and Shizuka stepped back once more, gazing at the walkway that ran above the conveyor belt along the side of the wall.
Of course!
As the conveyor belt trundled forward, Shizuka walked in the opposite direction. Beside it, the walkway moving beneath her, Shizuka thrust her katana into a seam between the wall's greasy, stained breeze blocks. The mortar between them cracked, and Shizuka used both hands to push harder on the hilt of the blade. The conveyor belt trundled onward, dropping more trash into the spinning blades below, as Shizuka patiently kept pace with the wall, her blade now hanging there, embedded in the old mortar. She stopped before the sword that poked out from the wall. The katana was embedded to about one-third of its length, leaving almost 2 feet of steel and hilt sticking out from the wall at roughly shoulder height. Eyes on the blade, Shizuka stepped back. She hunkered into herself, coiling her body like a spring, before rushing the 3 short steps that took her to the wall. As she reached the wall, her right hand slapped against the hilt of the katana, and the flexible blade curved just a little toward the surface of the conveyor belt as Shizuka leaped upward. As the blade sprang back into shape, Shizuka pushed off from it with her right hand, her left striving upward to grab for the edge of the high walkway. The walkway was just 5 feet above her, and the stretch of her body as she flung herself up was sufficient to grab hold of its edge. She swung there, dangling from her left hand, all of her weight pulling down on that desperate grip as she kicked with her legs, keeping her momentum going to continue the arc of her movement. Her right hand left the hilt of the blade now, and it darted through the air, crossing her body and lunging high over her head. Her arm crashed onto the surface of the walkway from fingertips to elbow, now sharing her weight with her left hand, still gripping just the edge. Her legs kicked out like a beached fish's tail, back and forth as she struggled to maintain her grip on the walkway. Relentlessly, she pulled herself up, her body swinging to and fro as her feet kicked frantically. Finally, her momentum carried her right leg above the level of the walkway, and it landed on the surface. From there, she powered the rest of her up and onto the walkway's surface. Securing her left hand on the safety bars that ran around the sides of the walkway, she dipped her body, bending her waist over the edge and reaching far down until she grabbed the hilt of her katana where she had embedded it in the wall. With her blade free, she swung herself, blade in hand, back onto the safety of the walkway.
Oh, what now?
Much as she wanted to track down and dismember the traitorous foe Grant, she knew that her number one priority was to warn Lakesh so that he could take action against the other two snakes in their midst.
Oh, Kane's one too. He just has to be.
A moment later, the samurai was on her feet, dashing along the walkway toward the exit.